I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement. And my guest today is Hathaway Berry.
I realized listening to these boys that they were being trained away from the rich experience of feeling their fear and having enough trust to know that it will take them to something else rather than all the defenses and protections and armoring that comes from, no, I don't want to do that. And that it's the greatest safety is actually just being willing to feel it and share it and see what comes out the other side. See what the book inspires in you and where that might take you. And hopefully it would incite some kind of dialogue and people would start to talk to each other, and that might be a little bit of bringing some of the things that are in the darkness out into the light a little more. And a lot of that is, I think, about fear, because I think fear is the big subject right now on the planet, and what we learn to do with it or not makes all the difference.
Hathaway Berry is a mediator and a parent. She lives in West Marin County, California. Welcome, Hathaway.
Thank you.
And you have written an extraordinary book that is called Boy, A Woman Listening to Men and Boys. How did you come to write this book?
Well, I was curious. I thought it was really inspired by a very painful romantic experience, which was just a straw on the camel. And I realized, oh my gosh, there's so much that I don't know. What is it to be a man? You know, what does it feel like? And what happens to boys growing up? That really alive quality, that joyful sense. I really wanted to know. So I went around and asked a lot of boys and men.
It was 80, wasn't it?
More than 80,
More than 80.
And then I had about, several dozen mini interviews. I basically was obsessed. Everywhere I was. Everywhere I go, I would just ask people on the bus or on the plane or in the waiting room or wherever it was. I just wanted to know. And I wanted to ask in a way that I might hear their more honest stories. So that was a lot of the, to get to, well, what's behind the behavior that was so confounding to me over all my whole lifetime in a way. And it was a good adventure.
Yes, 80 men. And you write in your book, everywhere you go now, you see men differently.
I do, because listening, you know, paying attention to anything that much and that consistently.
And how long did this take you?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I think I interviewed you in 2008, right. So that was the beginning of, I started asking questions, but I didn't have, by the time I interviewed you, was I talking about a book?
Or yes.
Just, I was.
Yes, you were.
Oh, okay. Because
and
initially...
you had your recorder.
Okay.
But you didn't know how you were going to get it onto the page.
Right. I just found out going along. And
right.
I didn't know. Initially, some guys were staying over, and one was in his 40s and one was in his 20s. And we stayed up late talking. And I started asking the questions that I would have liked to have asked this disappearing fellow. And they were so interested, and we had such a good time. And they said the next morning, we should do more of this. They wanted to do more. So it got me kind of inspired, and I thought, so that would be in February of that same year.
Of 2008.
And so I didn't know then, and I just started asking. It was a complete inquiry, just an act of trust. I just was going to find out, like, the things I really wanted to know. And so I didn't record the original interviews because I didn't think of myself that way.
Oh, okay.
And I was scribbling on a pad, and I started to have some questions, and then the questions grew and changed over time. And women added things that they wanted me to ask, and sometimes I would notice some recurring theme or a topic that would come up with guys. And so I would add that because it seemed to be so prevalent And it didn't seem like they were aware that it was so prevalent.
The men you were talking to. And there's a couple of things I want to mention right away, and that is the cover of this book. Whose photograph is that?
I love this cover.
It's extraordinary.
It is just extraordinary. And it was, it's a photographer named Wynne Bullock, who was a contemporary of Ansel Adams and Edward Weston and those guys. He lived down in Carmel, Monterey area. I somehow saw that picture decades ago, and I fell in love with it. And I found online you could get a poster. So I framed it, and it's been hanging in my house for decades.
Yes, we're in your house doing this interview.
And there it is, right over there.
Thankful for your inviting me to come and do this interview with you here.
And anyway, so I tracked down his daughter, who is the executor of his estate.
Okay.
And went to meet her, and we had such a good time. Hmm. And so I learned a lot more of the backstory of the photograph. Anyway, from the outset, when I realized, oh my goodness, I should put this some kind of book form because I had so many interviews, that's the only cover I could imagine.
There are really wonderful photographs throughout the book. You write in your book, you were listening without an agenda.
Yeah.
Other than maybe wanting to understand men, is what you said earlier.
Yeah. And so it was really out of great love and great pain that I was listening. And I think of myself as a pretty good listener, but I realized, oh, maybe I have to listen more deeply.
Yeah.
And so I started to, I learned a lot in the process of listening more deeply. Mm-hmm. And I could watch, this is important. Before I interviewed anybody, I sent a little blurb to each man who agreed to be interviewed, saying my commitment was to listen with no blame or judgment. And that was really a commitment to myself.
Okay.
So it was a practice that I got better at. And I could have, it was a chance to watch how I would react and realize, oh, it doesn't help when I react. Then if, you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
That it just adds, something changes in the air. But if I'm just listening, then there's a chance to be whoever they are.
Well, and I found that to be quite remarkable. One of the things that really continues to impress me is how open you were in your listening, so that the replies that you got, whether it's a quote, because you have quotes and you have extended stories, that people were really speaking from the heart.
They were. That's what was so moving to me. I mean, I loved
interviewing.
Really?
I would say. Oh. Well, it's unusual for a man to talk to another man in the way that men talked to you.
Well, I'm very aware that that's a privilege that women have, that we do are able to talk to each other.
Right.
And there's a lot of privileges we don't have in this culture, but that is definitely a saving grace. And I also, the privilege I had listening with these men was I wasn't any role. I wasn't anything in particular.
Right.
You know, I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a trained interviewer. I'm not a sociologist or an anthropologist or a journalist even. I'm really nobody. And in the sense of I didn't have that particular training to be looking through. I really wanted to learn. And I also was not, I wasn't a wife, their wife. I wasn't their or partner. I wasn't their boss. I wasn't their colleague. I wasn't anything, really, except another human being who happened to be female.
Right. I believe that your training as a mediator, though,
yes,
helped with the listening.
Oh, definitely.
I want to also speak about what you wrote about in the beginning part of the book, that you didn't know what to do with all the stories that you had been told, so you decided to go to the desert.
Well, I often have that feeling. I feel overwhelmed, and I think, oh, I just want some space.
Uh-huh.
And in that, all that space and quiet, I can be still and the flurry of thoughts and worry kind of quiets, and I can hear more clearly.
Right. So the first thing that came to my attention was you wanted to know, what is the joy of being a boy?
Yes, I thought that would be a good place to start. It wasn't my first question, but when I arranged,
we'll talk about
right,
that.
Right. So because I have a son and a daughter, and you know when they come out that there's that aliveness, that incredible joy, and I became aware that seems to diminish as they begin to enter the culture, and in particular, the male culture.
The joy was diminishing. Because you wrote, well, who is this boy that was your son?
Yeah, and I was very curious. I love following him around. I find him still endlessly fascinating. And I'm curious about what is the difference. I shouldn't probably say this on this interview, but I would say as he got older and I realized, oh my God, he's a boy, he has to navigate this world. You go out and tell me what you find out, like a scout, and tell me, you know, come tell me, you know.
Yeah.
And so he would sort of have this camaraderie over, he was going out to see what's this like.
Right.
And then, of course, he just joined that in his own beautiful
right.
way.
Well, and you write, the joy of being a boy is not knowing.
It is, don't you think?
Oh, I completely agree.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that brings wisdom, is if one can be in a place of not knowing what we can't know and trusting that we will be able to respond appropriately. But many people feel as if they have to pretend that they know.
Yeah, right? And I think especially guys.
Yeah.
Because it seems to be part of the male, you know, I was never told to woman up, for instance. You know, I mean, really, it's a big deal. There's a way I became heightenedly aware of what is required of these young boys with all this joy when they're entering this concept of, quote, being a man.
Yeah.
I didn't have that extra.
Right.
I mean, there are things that you have to do being a woman, but it seems to happen more organically, like your body goes through these changes, and you have that great, more grace chance, in my experience. I've never been a man. But again and again, I heard about all the pressures and the burden of this thing, being a man.
You also write about, on page 61, the Equal Rights Amendment, you don't know what you don't know, and that as a woman with men, more male privilege is often silent.
Well, I grew up in a household, a big family with two brothers and two sisters, and privilege. And I was aware that the males had a different kind of privilege, that we all had privilege, but they had a different kind. And
you were aware of that very early?
I would say, you know, starting going into adolescence.
Oh, okay.
And I thought, what's up with this? You know? I mean, why?
Right.
Why? And when I first heard of the notion of an equal rights amendment, I truly was baffled. You know how as a kid you hear these concepts.
Right.
You know, you hear concepts and you think, really? You know?
You mean not?
Well, exactly. Why would we need one?
Right.
You know, it's like, why do we need the term racism? Well, we do. Because it's not done, you know?
Right.
But it did seem like a whole extra thing, and I puzzled over it quite a while.
Well, and you also talk about this big ball of boy energy. You can't quite be vulnerable, even with close friends.
Well, that's a quote, probably.
Yes.
From one of the guys saying that. And that was often, I heard that a lot.
And you talk about shyness, too, about how you write that men are starving for connection. And I don't disagree with that for a moment. But what was your understanding?
Well, that was a quote from a man, that men are starving for connection.
Okay.
And I did hear quite a bit. There it was the whole gamut of people who felt they had lots of friends and those who were lonesome for friends. And for quite an age range, too. And the younger guys seemed to have more ease at it. because I think the culture is changing. And some of the older men, one was saying the only way to have friendships was to go fishing or, you know, not talk and then drink and tell dirty jokes or talk about women or something. And it wasn't satisfying to any of them, but they didn't know how. And that's the thing, which I totally appreciate. Where would you get the practice?
The range of males that you've interviewed was all the way from 8 or 9 to 94. 9 to 94.
Yeah, that wasn't intentional. I started interviewing guys more 50s and 60s because that's what I was curious about. Baffled. And then I became more interested in younger guys. And so that, and actually the favorites, my favorites were the preteens. Favorites, but I think we all agree that they do have a lot of clarity and sanity.
Well, there's really profundity.
Profound
things that they speak about that I look at as a guy now who's 60 and in my 60s, and they really are speaking the truth. They're not...
It's not filtered.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We had such a good time together.
Yeah.
And one guy, I write about him in the end of the book, that he happened in on, I was interviewing his best friend, and he was just came by the apartment. And he said, oh, what's up? You know, sat down, and he just joined right in. And we had... And he has a number of quotes in there. And at the end, he said, this is cool. So we're going to do this every week now? You know? And I thought, yeah, why don't we just listen? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things also you speak about is that gays bridge the masculine and feminine.
Well, I don't. Again, I refer to the men's quotes themselves. There's one gay man who speaks about that. Gays are a bridge between masculine and feminine. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of different variety. There are gay men, there's transgender men, a ex-con, a hedge fund CEO, a Native American guy growing up on a reservation, there's a tantra instructor, educator, and there's 17 different stories that are the main long stories, and then in between are little snippets from everybody else.
Oh gosh.
So it's like a chorus of voices.
Yep.
And because I wanted everybody to have at least a line or two, and so it's fatter than I might have liked. But I wanted to include everybody because the voices are so important. And even though some of it is repetitious, I think it began to make a point to me.
Yeah, I didn't find it to be repetitious.
You didn't?
I found it to be really enriching. And I think the thing that is such a lovely quality to your book is you can dive into the longer stories, or if the book happens to be sitting on the coffee table, look in and get a couple of quotes. And you were speaking about two that you are beginning to hear about couples who are exploring masculinity.
Reading it together,
yeah. Right.
Yeah, and guys, it's been interesting. A lot of different people have taken an interest.
You hear people saying, I feel like I'm faking it. And one of the most poignant quotes I've read is someone said, please don't be angry with me when I tell you the truth.
Right, right.
What an interesting idea that someone would be angry with someone else for telling the truth.
And very common. And I think that's where it starts.
For men.
Very common. Well, for women too, but especially men because of the expectation. And when you think of it, when you're little and that happens, something shuts down. And you realize it's safer not to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, if parents were paying attention in a way that whatever came out of their kid's mouth was worth listening to, there would be a lot more safety to really reveal, because kids don't know. They're just finding their way, you know?
Yeah.
So really, it's really about listening to boys and not listening without the expectation of who they're to become.
Oh, so there's none of this man up or toughen up or
boys don't
cry or that stuff.
Because they are just, anybody who has children knows this, that you see them when they're little, they're just that alive, vulnerable creature wide open to the world. Mm-hmm. And why would we want to shut that down?
And you find that these people, these young boys, are different than girls in terms of their energy.
There is a biology difference,
well,
for
right,
sure. Yeah,
right.
That openness, I think,
experience.
Is also true for girls. But this was the focus of the book, was boys, because
right.
That was my...
That was your interest.
Interest, and I feel like I've been a woman for all my life. So I didn't...
Right.
It's what I don't know about so much.
Right.
And I was very touched to hear the stories about boys growing up, how much violence.
You write... If men are going to change, women will have to allow it. And it's a real challenge for a woman to get clear what it is they really want in a man.
Yeah, and again, those are quotes from the men.
Right.
And that's part of my learning, was realizing the degree to which, as a woman, I'm complicit in this whole system that isn't benefiting either. If I carry on the expectations that the culture has for how a man should be, and I have those.
Oh, unconsciously.
Unconsciously,
right,
yeah.
Right.
Well, you know, as a lot of guys said to me, yeah, all these things I'm supposed to, I should read you that list. It's very funny that this one guy was talking about, I'm supposed to know how to deal with the snake.
Right.
Remember the snake
right.
in the garage, and I'm supposed to be able to fix the washing machine, and I'm supposed to know how to with a parking place in the city, and that the car will be okay, and
program the computer,
everything. You know, you're supposed to know all these things, and why? You know, so I realized I'm complicit in that.
Well, and we become, as men, speaking for myself, habituated about fixing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
mm-hmm.
I want to connect with you, so
mm-hmm.
I'll fix stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I remember hearing a story that a woman told, and that she was so frustrated because all her father could ask when she came to visit him was if he could change the oil in her car. Right?
Right.
And someone said to her, well, maybe that's the only way that he can say he loves you.
Exactly.
And she was just dumbstruck.
Right. And that's what I appreciate, that all those things are expressions of love, and that knowing how to express love isn't something that traditionally has been given a lot of room in in grade school, for instance.
Right.
That's not, and if the image of me is, for a boy, is I'm supposed to be tough and strong and be on top and
right.
dominate.
Right.
That's what makes it hard to be loving.
Right, right. Well, and that I'm the one that's supposed to fix things.
Right.
So it brought me to my own question for you. What do women find most attractive in a man? Is it confidence? Because I know, particularly in these days of women wanting to do what they do, take care of themselves.
Right.
Women don't always want stuff fixed. They can fix it for themselves.
Right.
But what is it that women find attractive in a man?
I couldn't presume to talk for women.
Sure, but I mean...
But I know for myself, it's some sense of comfortableness with themselves.
More than confidence.
And, yeah, because confidence is sometimes a kind of bravado.
Well,
you
right,
know?
Right,
and
right.
comfortable means that whatever comes through is okay. There's room
mm-hmm.
for it. Because if they're comfortable with themselves, they're more apt to be comfortable with me. And if they know their own joy, that's a great freedom.
So next, we come to the topic of violence, and this is in your chapter 2. And your question was, if you could have the imagination and a way to express whatever you need to express, would you need to be violent?
Yeah.
And so many men have participated and experienced violence, both as recipients and perpetrators. There's this boys will be boys, and violence normalized, and winning is everything. You write 1 in 6 boys will be sexually abused. That was stunning to me.
Yes, it was stunning to me, and it's actually probably not true. It's probably more, because that's just reported.
Oh, gosh.
So, you know, and that's where something like, because now sexual abuse in women is talked about.
Right.
And there
There's
are places to go.
Yeah.
And so that became something that I felt should be named more and brought out so that it doesn't become a stigma, and it's us. Everybody's suffering.
Right.
And then there's a sense of we're in it together and not making somebody wrong
Right.
But you can imagine it's the opposite of all the expectations, traditional expectations, of being a man. Because you, to in order to heal, you have to be vulnerable, you have to share your pain,
oh,
you have to ask
right.
for help.
Yeah.
And that's kind
when
of...
When you don't do that, it just is...
It just gets stored in the body and
yeah.
kind of leaks out in other ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't go away.
It was
itself.
Stunning to read that one of the men that you spoke with that was counseling people on death row was that 100% of the people on death row had been sexually abused.
Of the ones he had talked to. Yeah,
yeah.
I don't know,
you yeah.
know, he could make that claim, but yes, absolutely. And it was very moving because he himself had been sexually abused
mm-hmm.
and he had been working with one guy in particular, and then there was a film made, and in it there's a scene where he is talking through the glass, and the inmate who's going to be executed puts his hand up on the glass partition between the whatever it is, plexiglass.
Mm-hmm.
And then this man also puts his hand matching, and they can't touch each other.
Right.
But because he has just shared about his own abuse, and suddenly it isn't you, the black guy on death row, that it's me, you know, it's all of us.
We have to take a short break.
Okay.
I'm Anthony Wright. I'm your host today on Attunement, and my guest today is Hathaway Berry. And Hathaway has written a book called Boy, Women Listening to Men and Boys. So before the break, Hathaway, we were talking about how men had experienced violence. And I wondered about if the violence was kind of a testosterone shadow, because I remember you had written in the book how you were interested to get a sense of what testosterone must feel like in the body. Can you speak to us some more about, because I think it was one of the important things in your book about how many men experience violence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the most surprising thing, the amount and prevalence of violence growing up, that everyone that I listened to had some kind. And by violence, I don't just mean getting beat up or sexually abused or, you know, being in a gang or something, but the violence of not being allowed to be who you are. I mean, right from that get-go, when there's this idea of who you're supposed to be, to me, that's a violence to the spirit. And so even the boys who grew up in the most loving homes, when they hit the playground or the street or wherever, it's a culture of violence that we're living in. There's no one to point to, and there's no blame. We're all participating in it, creating it moment to moment. What I noticed is that there wasn't a lot of help knowing what to do with vulnerable feelings, and especially feelings like, I mean, what's behind the violence? That was my question. What is this going on? And of course, there's fear. And that's the most human, common emotion for all of us. But from what I was hearing, there isn't a lot of help when you're young knowing what to do with it.
Oh,
and
right.
as one guy said...
Even when we're older, there's not
exactly,
a lot of help.
Exactly. And one guy said, there's more permission to be violent than there is to be vulnerable in our culture. And so that's where, as parents, we're being complicit in this, because any way we behave toward children is they're looking to it, they're learning from it, and they're picking up what's around. And I just this weekend heard the most beautiful man speak. Clarence Jones, do you know who he is?
Mm-mm.
He was Martin Luther King's attorney and speechwriter.
Oh my goodness.
He's 85 years old. He's just beautiful and clear as can be. And he told the story, speaking of violence, that when he was a little boy, he was riding his bike, and a group of white boys surrounded him and started taunting him and wanted his bike. And he just was terrified. He really, really experienced fear. Came home, and his mom was, she expected him to be very empathetic when he was in tears, crying, talking about it. She said, "You come over here," and grabbed him by the collar, put him right in front of the mirror and said, "Look in the mirror." He said, "You see that person there? What do you see?" And he said, "Well, I see you, I see me." And she said, "No, no, look closer." And she said, and he looked closer and he said, "You know, And then the mom said, and because then suddenly she was softening, said, who you see in there is beautiful. That boy is beautiful. He is intelligent. He is capable. He don't ever believe a word of things that you hear from outside like that. It has nothing to do with who
you are. What an incredible support.
Isn't that incredible? He said that moment has lasted him his lifetime.
Yeah.
And so if more boys were hearing that from their parents, from their coaches, from their relatives, and just...
From their wives.
From the world. From their wives, right. But sometimes even if you hear it from your wife, if you heard it from your mother quite young, still hard to believe, you know, that core... I mean, really, that was my deepest concern, is how are we treating boys?
And you write, the behaviors you experienced with men began to make sense.
Yeah, because if you at such a young age are treated in a violent way, then in order to survive, you have to protect yourself. And it isn't safe to be empathetic. So a lot of the empathy for oneself, if you fall down and cut yourself, and you say, get up, it doesn't hurt, be a man, come on, man up, get it back out there on the field, whatever it is. You're losing empathy for yourself. And if you don't have it for yourself, how can you have it for anyone else?
Yeah.
You know, and I think what's poignant, and several men talked about this, that if that happens long enough, you lose access. You know you're missing something, but you don't know what.
Oh, right.
And you don't know how to get back. And that was the biggest mantra takeaway for me in terms of seeing men differently. Now, whenever I'm confounded again, I think, oh, they don't know how.
Right.
And not in a condescending way, not like, oh, I do. It's just nobody showed them. And so this is the best they know, which frees me up to not react and not participate.
Oh, I see. And did you find that men were finding their way back to their vulnerability through your conversations?
Well, and also on their own. And that's what was so encouraging to me about the whole process. And most of the stories in the book are that way, where you see what they go through and how they're finding their way back.
And that's one of the points of generativity in the book, where it can be very useful. I know it's been useful for me as a man to look at that and, oh, geez, they experienced that too.
Yeah, yeah, and they finding their way back to that joy of being a boy.
Right.
You know,
right.
which is aliveness, which is really just about being present, you know. And that's the not knowing mind, rather than I'm supposed to know because I'm a guy.
Well, and you write, when do men just get to be human beings?
Exactly. Just present, because, you know, if you tilt into hope or fear, it robs you of the present. You don't get to be in the moment. And my experience is that being present brings clarity and the energy needed to do whatever needs to be done.
And you found that so many men had covered it with addiction and projecting blame on others and stonewalling and running away. And it reminds me of one of our main political candidates
exactly. Well, no, and you look around in general at world leaders, so many, if you look at their childhoods,
yes,
you know, that they're still working something out, but at everybody's expense.
Boy, oh boy.
And not all of them, of course, but you can tell the difference. And you told me yesterday about how different Bernie Sanders responded to a bird, you know, than Donald Trump.
It was amazing.
And so somewhere that tenderness in him was allowed. He didn't feel he had to completely cover
it
over.
Right.
And that's where everybody's responsible. That's what I feel like. We're all participating in how we treat each other.
And I think one of the next things that I want to move on to is you talk about listening and language. And you say, why is it so hard for men to listen?
Yes. That was one of the main inspirations of the inquiry. Because in my experience, I was tired of listening to men and them not listening in return. And I was either going to give up on men, or I thought I'd have to come closer and listen more deeply. Because my experience is most of us would rather be listened to than listen. And I don't put blame about that. I feel there's just not enough listening in our early world, you know?
even now
in our day-to-day world. So there's a kind of, that's when the guy said starving for connection.
Yes.
It's listening, but it's a feeling of connection and remembering that intimacy that we come with.
Right.
You know, and that those little boys, the way they're so at ease with each other, tell they can't be, you know, how they are, and that intimacy is who we are. And I think that all this violent behavior comes out of, or addiction, any violence to oneself, comes out of missing that, being trained away or falling away from that original sense of intimacy with oneself.
Oh, sure, because it's got to have some expression, and it's got a lot of power behind it with the testosterone. So a lot of it comes out in unreason and frustration.
Well, I also heard that there weren't a lot of boys did not feel they had a lot of guidance.
Right.
Not because boys were totally ignored, but because so many men in their lives didn't know themselves what to do.
Right.
It's kind of like, I didn't know how to be a guy. On certain things, how could I guide my son? You know.
Right.
But there is a sense that the thing I found heartening was that there, with younger, especially the younger men, there are more and more who are, they don't want to miss being a dad. They want to be involved in their kids' lives. And
yeah.
and they're letting their child teach them.
Oh, how lovely.
Yeah, well, in the sense that they're getting to relive their childhood and they're getting to redo and have a sense of, oh my gosh, how I would have loved to have been treated.
Right.
Instead
so
of
they
just
become the dad they always wanted.
Exactly.
To have.
Instead of just
I had that experience in my own raising my own kids.
Yeah,
I got to be the dad I always wanted to have.
Yay! Congratulations.
Oh,
it's a very healing.
It is, and I continue to have a great relationship with my kids. Toward the end of the book, you begin to talk about some wisdoms that come with age. You said with age, oxytocin production begins to increase with older men. And it makes room to be a better listener. But I want to stop for a moment and ask you what your experience was as your skill as a listener deepened and developed. And how did you do that?
Well, I don't know. you kind of sit down, shut up, and pay attention, you know?
Well, and you had an intention and an openness.
Yeah. And I think just practice, like with anything, I keep doing it. So I would notice that I could feel the reaction or judgment come up in my mind. And I literally, at a certain point, trained myself not to raise my eyebrows or drop my jaw.
Oh.
Yeah. So
anything that you'd heard, it was just...
Yeah, it's just life. It's just the flow of life.
Uh-huh.
And who am I to know, you know? And so I think it became safer. And it was more fun, you know, it's more fun for me. I mean, it's those judgments that separate us, you know, and so it just made the whole experience more fun. So I got an immediate feedback. If I wasn't having fun, then there was something I was doing that was off.
Because I know a lot of us want to know how to listen better.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate that. We can put down the burden of self-importance and experience the joy of losing our carefully constructed selves for a moment.
Yes, how old was that man do you have there?
In his 70s.
In his 70s, yeah. That's what I found, that as guys got near their 70s, oftentimes the softening, because that's where I say it's a part of the culture. Mm-hmm. The culture allows it, and they have less testosterone. I do have new heightened respect for what I don't know about testosterone. I really do, because everybody mentioned it in one way or another.
Right.
And I've heard those stories of when a woman is injected with testosterone and how differently they feel. So if I had that hormone, that injection of hormone, or just happening with puberty as a male, I would really want somebody to help me with it. To say, oh, yeah, and this is what you've got. And there's a couple of stories in there where fathers are saying to their son. I don't know if you remember the one that there was a guy who, on the lacrosse field or something, was an explosion of adrenaline and he came off the field and he just went into this rage, this sweet little boy, right? And he came off the field and I think somebody bumped into him really hard and And he was just had exploded, and he turned to his dad and he said, "What was that?" And his dad said, "It's a Molotov cocktail, you know, the mixture of adrenaline and testosterone." Yeah, yeah. So he had some older person to look to,
right,
and to name it and to not make him wrong for it, you know.
And, well, and also to model how to experience what he experienced without reaction.
Yeah, yeah.
Boy, that's really incredibly important.
Yeah, and so in the best sense, I'm very optimistic because it gives everyone the chance, if you're relating to children, to practice these things.
Well, next we come to what you close your book with, which was the first question you asked men.
Oh, yes.
And when you asked me this question, I was on the floor laughing for about 3 to 5 minutes, and you said to me, "I've never had anyone respond that way before." And so what is the question?
What would you love women to understand?
No one has asked me that question since. And it's, I had that response because of sheer relief.
Uh-huh.
That a woman had finally asked.
And do you remember what you said?
Yeah, I got pretty long-winded.
Oh.
And, but I just wanted to say it was a relief.
Oh,
and
good.
That there were many men who responded quite positively to this question, and some couldn't respond at all, right?
Right, right. So I asked the question because I realized there were a lot of things I would like men to understand, so I thought they must, that perhaps they would like the same thing in return.
Right,
so.
Right.
I asked it, and some guys were just completely stopped by it. They really didn't know what to say. That is just too big, you know.
Right.
Or they were just, his jaw would drop. It's like, and I'd say, "Well, we can come back to that later." And sometimes people did later in the interview, and sometimes I could tell they didn't want to come back to it. So, maybe it was too loaded. Maybe it was too big. I don't know. But it seemed to be a big question.
And then in your afterword, you have a number of statements. You say this inquiry was born of heartache.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about your son?
No, it was about a man, a particular man.
Oh, the relationship.
But it was more than that, because it was it was the opening. Because of the depth of connection I felt with him, it kept me open to inquiring, like, well, what could possibly be behind some of these kinds of behavior? I genuinely wanted to learn how to love.
And you had gotten beyond response and reaction at that point and into curiosity.
Yeah, because it was the only way. Because otherwise, I was just going to give up.
Yeah.
On men. So I thought, okay.
What a wonderful state.
Just, yeah, it was. I was grateful in a way because my commitment to myself was just, no matter what, just keep your heart open, keep your heart open. And because I just couldn't believe some of the behaviors, and if I didn't make it wrong but got curious about it, then it would inevitably lead me to a very tender, vulnerable place in myself and in that person.
Yes.
And I realized, oh, that's our commonality, you know, that's where the connection happens, and it's so much juicier.
Oh, yes. Well, you say, "I wanted to learn to love well. I was listening for that boy."
Yes, because to be able to sit with these guys when they were talking about, when I asked what's the joy of being a boy, it was really beautiful to see how their faces changed.
Oh.
And really, it was
a
really lovely moment. And I felt like I was kind of entering their boy world in a way I hadn't ever really done before, because I could feel them, you know, it calls up the memory, and that part comes very much alive.
And what a joyful thing to be witnessed.
Oh, well, it was very fun to be there.
Yes. You said you've written about a new mantra.
Oh, that's what I mentioned before. My new mantra is, they don't know how. For any situation where I feel challenging and I start to see myself contracting or pulling away, it's like, you know, making the other person wrong or the situation wrong. And I just think, oh, this too is life. What am I not listening to? What am I not willing to include?
And you say, everywhere I go now, I see men differently.
Yes, I do. I do, after all that time.
Yes.
More empathy. I feel I have more empathy.
Okay.
Yeah.
So a couple of questions about What has this book done for your inner masculine?
I don't know. Tell me what my inner masculine is.
Well, that's one of the things you explore a bit about the inner feminine with men, right?
Oh, I think, I just didn't call it that way. Let's see.
But you have an inner masculine, and I think you've been changed by meeting these men in such an open way through a whole spectrum of life. And I think the thing that really continues to impress me about the book is the openness, that I can read a story or I can read a quote and go away and contemplate it. And it's framed in such a way, without judgment, without agenda, that I go, huh, how does that resonate in me and how does that open in me, like something blooming?
Uh-huh.
But what's your experience, your inner masculine? Do you feel you know men better?
Well, I don't know. What I know is I don't know. There's that quality of openness. I don't know. I feel more receptive to who is actually there instead of my interpretation or my projection. And I just have a lot more tender feeling towards that. But in terms of...
Do you resonate with men more deeply then?
I don't know. I hope so. I don't know.
Do you find it's easier to have conversations about these kinds
of
topics?
Oh, okay. So I see where you're going. All right. Well, I think because of having this incredible chance to listen to such a variety of males for so long, that it's unusual because it's not, they weren't, it is, because they weren't, that it, there wasn't, it wasn't fraught, as I said, with the personal relationship part of it. It was just the listening. So it become more of a habitual way.
Yes.
Like, that's what I said before about just sit down, shut up, and pay attention. That being able to do that and have the habit of not putting my story in between whatever wants to happen.
Boy, that's
so important.
Whatever
wants to happen.
Yeah, yeah. And you were able to do that through practice? Because initially your story would show up and get in the way, was that?
Well, I don't know, different times. But it's a kind of, it feels very ordinary because I've hung out with so many guys now. I was a tomboy.
Right.
So I always liked hanging out with guys.
Yeah.
And I just wondered why they started to put on all this extra stuff. I kind of missed them. And it's like I was waiting for that to relax. So I feel in this situation I got to do that more with a variety of different people. And that was fun.
Yes. How did this book all come together? What was that process like?
Oh, well, that was the hard part. I loved, as I said, listening to these guys. We had a great time. But then having these heaps of transcripts was overwhelming to me because...
80 guys
more. But many hours of transcripts were. So I just had stacks and stacks. It was truly overwhelming. I didn't have a clue what to do. And I don't have training of making books or organizing for a PhD, and I never wanted a PhD. Excuse me.
Right.
I know you just, congratulations, you just got your PhD.
Well,
but I didn't want mine because it isn't my ambition to become an expert on men or anything really. But I loved the process so much. And then I had all this result. And I thought, well, I want at least to give this back to the guys that I interviewed because it really was, I felt very, very grateful. I learned a lot from them, and they were very gracious to share so openly. So that was where the idea of book came in, because, okay, here's the stuff. What is it that I'm going to put together to give back? And that's why I would go to the desert a lot and go to different places where I thought, what does it all distill to? And I have tremendous respect for real journalists, writers who do this for us all the time, who go out and do all this exploration and then distill it.
Right.
You know, it's like the image that kept coming was that hourglass. Like it comes, all that stuff comes through that hourglass and we get the benefit. And I didn't know how to do that at all. And so it took me very long, and pretty soon the papers literally covered the house, and they were just everywhere because I can't hold it in my mind. And even if it's on a computer, if it's in a file, it's like gone to me.
Right.
So I just had to put everything out. And then I would just, well, one in particular, I remember taking them all to this friend's guest house in Arizona. Beautiful canyon. I do like empty desert. And I put them out all over the floor. And then my friend brought another fold-out table, 6-foot table. And we covered that. And we covered the couches. We covered the chair. We covered this whole room was covered. And then I just sat down in the middle. I mean, I remember this moment, sitting down on my knees and kind of throwing my hands up like, well, what do I do? And then I would just listen. It was like listening again to the listening. And so I thought, nobody else is going to do this for me. And I'd get up and I'd start to just move papers. And I'd put, oh, well, this kind of goes maybe with that or maybe with this. And literally it's like shuffling them around and seeing what voices were talking and where they might want to go. And
but trying, you were open to that.
Yeah, trying to listen to something else that, you know, what...
Oh, so there was a listening underneath that was going on.
So, yeah, that's the hardest part for me, was trying to put it together and thinking... I made so many different versions of this book and then would share it with people and get their feedback and think, how does this go? How does this go? And that was another listening. So then I was listening to the people who were reading it and giving me input. But my first commitment was to the guys that I listened to, because the people who were reading didn't have that experience of being there. So I'd sometimes, you know, three different readers would say, no, I take this voice out. And I think, no, that one's got to stay.
Yeah.
You know, so it was like that, a lot of...
So it was almost a landscape, in a manner of speaking.
How so?
Well, an emotional landscape.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of, and things kind of, this goes over here and that goes over
yeah,
there.
Yeah, kind
that,
of arranging it, yeah.
And then you got a feeling for where things went, and it felt better and better, and then you went, oh, that feels right.
Yes.
But then the whole thing comes together as a, again, I talk about this idea of a blooming, you know, kind of, oh, look at all of this. Look what's over there and what's over there, and they're all related. And there's a deepened feeling about masculinity now.
Well, thank you. I hope that's so. You know, I don't know. You know, I'm just kind of finger painting and seeing how it happens. But at a certain point then, it's like, this is as much as I can do.
Right.
And I have to just let it go, because what I most cared about was giving it back to the guys and seeing what their response was and if I had been true to their voice.
Right. And you also said... in our conversation yesterday about what is the truest humanity. And also, you mentioned that this book is a response to climate change.
It is. It's my personal response to climate change, because, you know, you can't be alive now and not be aware of what we're doing on the planet. And I thought, well, how do I participate in this? And... it seems to me that how we treat each other is how we're going to treat the planet, and that is in fact happening. And so if I learned how to listen better, that was an effort at peacemaking.
Well, we're coming to the end of the interview. Is there anything that you'd like to say about your experience? What would you want to tell people about the book, if there was one thing you could say?
Well, I encourage you to buy it and start, have the conversation, you know, see what it inspires in you and where that might take you. And hopefully it would incite some kind of dialogue, and people would start to talk to each other, and that might be a little bit of bringing some of the things that are in the darkness out into the light a little more.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that is, I think, about fear, because I think fear is the big subject right now on the planet. And what we learn to do with it or not makes all the difference.
Yes.
So looking into whatever our fears are, and I realized listening to these boys that they were being trained away from the rich experience of feeling their fear and having enough trust to know that it will take them to something else rather than all the defenses and protections and armoring that comes from, no, I don't want to do that. And that it's the greatest safety is actually just being willing to feel it and share it and see what comes out the other side.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. This has been really fun. Thanks, Anthony.
You're very welcome. I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement. And my guest is Hathaway Berry, who has written a book called Boy, A Woman Listening to Men and Boys. And how can people contact you or find the book?
It's at Point Reyes Bookstore, and it's on Amazon and also at a website, listeningtomen.com.
Great. Well, thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.